Hi, I'm your friend Claude, and this is episode 10 of the Nerd Bomber Podcast.
So last week we mentioned, you know, going to the comic convention and seeing
Ithacon
43rd annual, seeing toys and things from our youth, from our childhood being resold. And unfortunately, sometimes that's the only way to recapture the feeling of playing with those items from that era, or at least getting the feeling of going to the place where you got them initially and kind of milking that feeling of wonder and delight. And unfortunately, somewhat recently, that ability has been dealt yet another blow with the news that Toys R Us will be closing all of its stores. I'm not sure what the timeline is on that, but pretty much effective immediately.
Yeah, I don't know, and it probably might change store to store depending on inventory and things like that, but yeah, I mean, it's pretty much, there were rumors early on when they filed for bankruptcy, and then it just kind of happened.
Yeah, I even heard initially that the plan was to keep the Canadian stores open and close all of them in America, but we're at the point where it's all of them and anywhere in the world. I don't know, anytime a big going out of business event happens like this, there's all kinds of rumors that sprout up. So, I mean, I've heard that in the wake of Toys R Us closing, KB might be coming back. I've heard that there's some guy who, I heard this like secondhand and I don't have the information in front of me, but there was another business owner of some type that announced plans to buy the name and buy as many of the existing stores as he could to sort of like keep it open in a smaller scale on his own. But I haven't heard anything else about that. So as of right now, Toys R Us is no more. And how you feel about it depends, I guess, on your proximity to a Toys R Us and your relationship to it as a kid. I mean, everybody knew about it. Everybody was exposed to it as an entity.
Well, their advertising campaign, Toys R Us Kids. Right. I mean, that was kind of the biggest thing. That's almost like the bigger piece of nostalgia to me than the actual store.
Right.
Is sort of the media presence of the store, because it's not like I was in a financial position as a kid that we just would go to Toys R Us and wander around and buy something. You know, if I was buying something for Toys R Us, it was probably because I had money from, you know, doing some chores or doing some sort of, you know, mowing lawns or whatever that was. And then, you know, getting to go and spend that money. And then the other thing was, you know, it would be, we would go there and not buy things and just like talk about what we would want. And that was like how our parents would sort of do Christmas shopping, was based on our ideas. That and like, you know, circling things out of like the big book of toys from, I think that was a Sears thing.
Right.
But,
Sears and JCPenney.
Yeah. Huh? Yeah. So it's still a nostalgic thing and kind of a bummer, because there is still, well, closer to where I live than where you live, there was still a Toys R Us pretty nearby, and I had been there fairly recently, so it is kind of a bummer to see that they're going to be just gone.
Yeah, and plus, I mean, as is well documented on this show, you have kids and I don't, so I don't know if that's another thing that you sort of were reliving through them that now you're not able to, or what was that like for you?
Well, that was one of the biggest reasons we would go. You know, we would go there during, you know, same thing, sort of like Christmas shopping season, and you know, we'd wander and just see if there was anything cool there. You know, and they've been there too. I don't know if they're going to look back on it with any sort of special nostalgia, like sort of our generation might.
Right.
And I don't know that I would ever have a reason for going there if it wasn't for them either. Because if I really had a need for some sort of thing that would offer, I don't know if that would be my first choice to go, just because of it's relatively close to where I live, but it's more of a haul than some other options that I might have closer to me. So, yeah, I don't know if that I would have much of experience in the store if it hadn't been for them since my childhood, but that was the biggest reason I would have been there anytime within the last decade.
Right. Because I'm a man child, and I took the I don't want to grow up, I'm a Toys R Us kid song literally and decided to make it my credo for how I approach living life. I have been and continue to go there throughout my adulthood. That specific Toys R Us location that you're mentioning just happened to have been my very first job, real adult job anyway. I started working there when I was 18, and that alone has given me, I guess, kind of cause to pop back in there from time to time throughout the years, just to kind of see how it evolved since I used to work there and kind of compare it to, you know, what it used to be like. And for a while, for a few years anyway, it would also be to kind of see people I used to work with or touch base. But I mean, obviously, as the years went on, fewer and fewer of them remained. And in fact, now I don't even know if there's anybody there that used to be there. Some of them lasted quite a while, but you know, it was cool for that. But I also happen to be a collector of toys and action figures for 23 years now, steady. And I got probably a third of my collection from my time working there, which is, you know, no coincidence.
You got the employee discount.
Yeah, unfortunately, it was only 10%, just like the Walmart discount.
Yeah.
And, you know, people have always had this impression that employees of any place are allowed to just, you know, grab whatever comes in off the truck that they want and hoard it in the back and whatever. Yeah. But you're really not.
You actually get in a lot of trouble for doing things like that.
Yeah, they would allow you to. There was a shelf in the back where you could kind of reserve something, but it was only like one item at a time, and it was only, I think, for 2 days before you had to put it back on the shelf. Like, you had to buy it within 2 days.
Mm-hmm.
So they would give you that kind of leeway, and perhaps that's where, like, the legend grew out of.
Yeah,
but, yeah, it was never this, I was never able to.
The whole underground market, shady backroom deals at Toys R Us.
Like, this is Claude's pile in the back. Don't touch it. You know, that didn't exist. But I did happen to work there at a really advantageous time in terms of Star Wars stuff being discounted, like 90s Star Wars stuff, which is actually what got me into it, collecting in general. So I built up a lot of my collection by getting, you know, markdowns from that time. Yeah, so
I think you got me reissues of the Ninja Turtles.
I did, but they actually didn't come from there. They came from KB.
Oh, did they?
Yeah, they were.
I've ruined the narrative.
Nah, it's relevant in that it's another big business, specifically a toy-related business, that is no longer in existence. I mean, KB was probably the second biggest toy presence ever behind Toys R Us. Did you have any other specific memories attached to them?
Yeah, I think there was a KB in Ithaca when we were kids.
For a time, yeah.
And there was definitely one in Syracuse, but like just sort of our family destinations for shopping and things like that, just when I was a kid, didn't really take us in those directions very often. So I just never found myself at KB Toys.
Right.
Only like sort of later as a sort of young adult would I wander into one.
Yeah.
Yeah, the Toys R Us was definitely more significant. I spent more time there. Actually, my big experience actually shopping at Toys R Us would have been in the 90s. Like I said, using money I got from like mowing lawns and things like that to buy video games. And I've never been a big gamer, but when I was a kid, I had a Sega Game Gear, which was a great portable system. It was a 8-bit color system that was technologically superior to Game Boy. But it would eat through like 6 AAA batteries in 2 hours. So like you had to have it plugged in all the times, which didn't make it very portable. Anyway, I digress. I remember specifically shopping in the video game section a lot in the store because I would use my money to buy Game Gear games. My toy buying experience as a kid didn't have much to do with stores. Like most of my toy collection as a kid came from either I would buy them like or I would get them as a present. So I didn't have the purchasing experience. Or I'd get them like secondhand.
Right.
Or like garage sales and things like that. I had a very eclectic mix of action figures as a kid. You know, I had a little bit of everything, but no complete sets.
Yeah, same here. It's actually kind of crazy when I go back. I'll see like people post stuff on Instagram or I'll see things on Pinterest or whatever. And you just kind of remember all the things you used to have. And, you know, like I grew up in a pretty tightly controlled financial household as well. probably more so, but.
Possibly.
I guess I like to say that we were poor. In some ways, we certainly would be considered poor, especially today. But I had a lot of random toys for being so so broke. So, yeah, that's the other kind of component to my association with Toys R Us and my memories is that, I guess, starting around probably when I was 10 or so, making the trip to Toys R Us and Chuck E. Cheese, which was brilliantly located right across the street.
That was really something. That is true. I forgot that Chuck E. Cheese used to be over there. That's right.
Yeah, that was like the...
This is in Binghamton, New York, is the town we're talking about, for just in case anybody doesn't know.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't like the next town over, so it was definitely kind of limited to like a once or twice a year thing. But we would go down there for pretty much all of our birthdays, my brother and sister and me. The tradition became, you know, you'd go to Chuck E. Cheese and get the pizza and play the games and then go pick something out of Toys R Us across the street. And like, what, as a kid, what could you possibly dream of that would be better? Or, you know,
I can't imagine. Disney World itself would be the only thing.
I'll tell you, yeah, I never got to go to Disney World until our senior trip when I was 18. I was a legal adult before I went to Disney World.
Same here.
And I'll tell you, the trips to Chuck E. Cheese and Toys R Us were certainly enough to get me through the years in terms of satisfaction. So I actually, as an adult, not only, you know, did I go there to kind of keep tabs on it after I quit working there, but also to kind of keep the tradition alive. Chuck E. Cheese moved, shut down in that location and moved like the next town over to Vestal. But it became this, you know, the modernized corporate version of Chuck E. Cheese where everything looks the same. It's all just this neon and kind of cheaper feeling. And
I haven't been inside it since they've moved it. My kids have been there with their mom, who we're not together anymore. We get along just fine, just in case anybody needs to know. everything's great. But I haven't been there since they moved it to the new spot. The thing that I remember most fondly about the Chuck E. Cheese is something they changed, even when it was still in its old location, that I was aware of the change and disappointed by, was they got rid of the Swiss cheese wall underneath the animatronic Chuck E. Cheese band, whatever that was. So they used to have these holes cut into the wall, and you could climb in and climb around different levels and poke your head out. And they did away with that, like, years before the location moved. Like, I remember still going there as a kid, being disappointed that there was no more cheese wall to climb in. That was my first experience with lost nostalgia.
tender age of, what, 8 or something?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, the cheese wall was amazing. The whole place was great. I'm sure now it would probably seem antiquated and cheesy, but that's kind of what made it so great. It was like a mini Disney World, you know. They had animatronic characters. They had like people in full size mascot costumes. They had, you know, entertainment music shows, and it really was a great concept for people just, you know, in our position, families that couldn't and never would be able to go to, you know, some of the bigger theme parks. This was kind of like a condensed theme park experience.
It was. You're right about that. Yeah.
But yeah, so Toys R Us did the same thing throughout the years. It was kind of the, you know, the more 80s version, like the rainbow stripe, I don't know how to describe it, on the outside. Like, if you Google pictures of Toys R Us, you'll see what I mean. They're like vertical stripes of like orange and red and blue and green, kind of looking kind of 70s, 80s-ish for a lot of Toys R Us's outer decor. I think that's kind of what people picture when they imagine Toys R Us. But that gave away to, you know, more modern, more plastic, more techie focused decor. Even when I was there, the store that I worked at was considered a test store for the company. And
interesting.
It was used to like try out things that they had planned to roll out like company wide, but maybe they wouldn't based on how it went there.
Right.
So it was a cool experience. It was definitely an amazing first job, especially if you were already kind of into like toys and collecting and stuff like that. To this day, I would say it's probably the favorite job I've had overall.
Wow.
I actually really like my job now, in terms of like, you know, obviously a job is always going to be a job and having to answer to somebody and all that stuff. But the job I have now is probably the first job since I worked at Toys R Us where I don't have some size of a knot in my stomach when I go there. So I guess I've got the bookend effect going.
Yeah, I guess that works.
But yeah, so throughout the years, I've every birthday, even when I turned 35 last year, we went to Toys R Us, and instead of Chuck E. Cheese, obviously, it's a little rougher for a 35-year-old to go there, especially now. They have, Binghamton has a sweet arcade
Robot City.
Game store. Yeah.
It's really good.
With a lot of the same games from the same era that you would find at Chuck E. Cheese back in the day. So it's almost like
I don't
miss any of the experience.
No, it's a great place. We're going a little bit off now. Robot City Arcades in Binghamton, New York is a great place because it goes the time span that it covers. You know, they got pinball machines going back to the 70s, and they got arcade machines going up till, you know, they got like a Mario Kart, like goes up to pretty modern period of time. So anybody can go there and have an experience that is either new or harkens back to some like sort of nostalgic time from their past. It's a great place. And actually, I've gotten into retro video gaming. I actually did a podcast about it on my own show, the Nerd Strong podcast. And it's a great store for that sort of thing, too. You know, cheap games I played when I was a kid. And so, yeah, I've had some good experiences there. Yeah, Chuck E. Cheese was great. And I was, I guess I'm not, I had as much of an experience with it as I could have had.
Right.
You know, so I guess it's less sad. And Chuck E. Cheese is still around. I guess it's less sad that it changed because it's not like I was still doing it. Mm. Toys R Us is a little bit more sad because I still would have had an opportunity to go there and now that's gone. But my nostalgia with it's a little bit weird anyway because it's not what you would expect, which is, you know, a little kid sort of gazing slack jawed at all the toys. That's not necessarily what I was doing there as a kid. But I still liked it. And like I said, the media presence of it, the commercials and Jeffrey, the giraffe, that was sort of the bigger sort of imprint on me.
A few actors even kind of got their start in those commercials. Some, I guess, more notable than others. But the ones that come off the top of my head are Jaleel White, who played Steve Urkel on Family Matters. Jenny Lewis, she was kind of a child actor who gave up acting and became a musician. She was, I guess, most notably in the Fred Savage movie, The Wizard, also about video games. And she formed the band Rilo Kiley in the 90s, and, you know, she kind of focuses on music now. And Lindsay Price, who is now married to celebrity chef Curtis Stone. She, I guess her most famous thing was probably soap operas, and she was on 90210 for 3 or 4 years in the later years. So a lot of careers, a lot of lives, a lot of just like pop culture presence is just gone. I mean, it's just crazy when stuff like this happens. The ultimate reason Toys R Us is gone is because of the climate that allows what they call vulture capitalism to exist. Mitt Romney used to be involved with a group called Bain Capital, and they were responsible for buying Toys R Us in 2005, buying up, I guess, their debt. It was called a leverage buyout. I'm not even exactly sure how it works, but basically they come in and buy it and then like sell their debt back to them so that they get out unscathed, but then leave Toys R Us holding the bag.
Right.
And the most frustrating aspect of it is, on paper, as a company, Toys R Us, even now, is still profitable, technically. Mm-hmm. But they just not profitable enough to pay off this debt that they're left with. So it's like, they're making money, but they have to go out of business. It's just, it's infuriating. So you hear all, you know, remember the big financial crash in 2008, and, you know, the banks are too big to fail, but a company like Toys R Us isn't?
Yeah.
You know? And personally, I don't believe anything should be or is too big to fail. But, I mean, why do you have certain corporations and entities getting treatment that protects them and other ones just, you know, they can fend for themselves, I guess?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of an age-old story.
Yeah,
I mean,
follow the money.
We've talked about it before. We'll talk about it again. Follow the money. speaking of toys, there's a Netflix show. Shall we jump in?
Do it.
The Toys That Made Us. I watched 3 episodes. There's only 4 episodes of the show right now. Supposedly it's going to go to 8 eventually. I watched episodes about the Star Wars toy craze, Masters of the Universe, and G.I. Joe. And it's funny because the show is fat. None of those toy lines were something that I was super into as a kid. I know, despite the fact that last week's episode we talked about how I wanted to buy a Prince Adam from the comic convention guy because I had a Prince Adam toy as a kid. But that just goes to show you that I was not a Masters of the Universe toy collector completionist because I did not have He-Man. I had Prince Adam. And I had some other like super, super obscure side characters. So anyway, But the show is fascinating because it really shows you like the back, you know, behind the scenes workings of sort of developing a toy line. And the Masters of the Universe one is actually especially interesting, I found. But it was just a great show. It brought back memories. It actually reminded me, because specifically, again, in the Masters of the Universe episode, they talk about all the sort of superfluous characters they created just to continue to grow the toy line. And the characters just got so obscure, and there were so many of them. But as they flashed across the screen, sometimes they wouldn't even mention who they were. They would just be in a bunch, and I'd be like, oh, I had that one. I had that one. I had that one. It's just weird how I had more He-Man characters than I thought I did, none of which were regular characters that like appeared on the cartoon series or anything like that, except for Prince Adam. I don't know if Roboto was ever on the show. Manny Faces, I think, was. I'm not so sure about the snake characters.
Yeah, Roboto was at least in one episode.
Yeah.
But the thing with especially the Masters of the Universe line, more so than maybe any other, is the notable difference in the way these characters and vehicles looked on the show versus in toy form. There was, depending on your level of attention to detail as a child, or your willingness to accept certain differences, there was quite a range in the appearances between the two forms. Even like main characters, like He-Man and Skeletor themselves were, everything was simplified for the cartoon, obviously.
Right.
But some of the characters and some of the vehicles and stuff looked almost unrecognizable on the show. You know, I mean, any number of things are responsible for that. But that was one of the hallmarks of that line, and later corrected much more recently with the Masters of the Universe Classics toy line that are strictly made for adults, not only because... that's who remembers playing with them as kids, but also because the price point is so high that no kid could afford them. but you're getting faithful versions now.
That's right. I saw an image of like a catalog. It looked like something right out of a toy catalog from the 1980s. It was like the I guess it was probably Castle Grayskull playset, and a, like a 30-year-old man standing over it, wide-eyed, smiling, just like a picture of a kid playing with a toy in a toy catalog from the time period that we're talking about. It was kind of actually hilarious and clever marketing.
As recently as 6 hours ago, it has been announced that Netflix has officially ordered a season 2 for The Toys That Made Us. Apparently that was kind of up in the air until today. Apparently.
So is that the other 4 episodes that I'm talking about, or were those already in the can, and now they're going beyond that?
No, I think those are the other episodes. But they're still, even the focus of those episodes is still not 100% solidified.
Oh, okay.
But there's a quote from the creators saying that they're definitely going to do a Power Rangers episode,
okay.
Ninja Turtles, My Little Pony. And they planned to round it out with wrestling figures.
Wow, that is a large thing to take on, because they've changed so much over the years.
Absolutely.
From those like completely, nearly unplayable figures, that is, in the early 80s, to the weirdly shaped ones. And then was it the late 90s, wrestling, at least WWE, did a line of wrestling where like the figures' bodies were like based on laser recreations of the real wrestler's body. So every figure was really accurate in terms of the muscle tone and definition and shape.
Yeah, they're...
I think what they found, those probably like too expensive to produce, when you could just use like sort of a couple base models to make...
I think they're called Real Scan. They actually still do that to this day, but just for the facial likeness.
Right, right.
And okay. They are kind of back to using generic bodies.
Yeah.
But I mean, that's kind of the best of both worlds, really.
I guess so, yep. It's funny. So like I said, I never was a big, like, I was never really into Star Wars, or not the movies, but the toys. As a kid, I was never into He-Man. I was never into G.I. Joe toys. And those were not the cartoons that I watched the most of. So I'm hoping to see Transformers. And you said they're Turtles is kind of, may very well happen. I want to see Thundercats. Thundercats and Transformers would be the two that I want to see the most, because those are the ones that I was most interested in as a kid.
Well, it's actually, Thundercats probably not as much, but it's actually really surprising to me that they wouldn't have gotten to Transformers earlier.
That's a pretty big time toy line, and
yeah,
it was made, I think it was kind of similar to how He-Man came about. You know, the toys, people think of the cartoon and the toys are based on the cartoon, but really the toys came first,
right?
And they made the cartoon based on that. I don't think that was the case with Thundercats. The Thundercats were a cartoon first.
Yeah. Because it came in the wake of the success of Masters of the Universe. I mean, it's a very similar type of property.
Fantasy, sci-fi mixed up with some supernatural elements, yeah.
Centering around, you know, a powerful sword and a main hero who wields it. And
yeah, that's very true. It's very true.
And yet, it's different enough to stand completely on its own.
Yep. It has one of the best cartoon intros of all time. The best, in my opinion. The best cartoon intro of all time belongs to Thundercats.
I go back and forth with that and Ninja Turtles, honestly.
Oh, I thought you were going to say Silverhawks.
No, I mean, that's more of a guilty pleasure. It is great. It's the same studio who put out Thundercats, so, you know, it's got a very similar format that it follows. But, yeah.
Ninja Turtles.
Yeah, it's
really good.
It's just so good at... It's a catchy as hell song.
Right.
It's stuck in your head. But it also so perfectly tells the story of the characters and gives you kind of a summary of what you're going to see and what it's about.
Yeah, it is very true. The next one that I like, we're jumping all over here. Now we're talking about favorite cartoon intros. The next one that I like is the X-Men cartoon from the 90s.
Yeah, you know what? That's certainly got to be top five, if not top three.
Right.
Very similar, though. And actually, there's a connection to Masters of the Universe. I don't know if they both did. The X-Men was put out by the same studio who put out Power Rangers, Saban. Haim Saban and Shuki Levy were the kind of producers, and they also did, I think it was Saban himself, did the music. And they were also around doing music for Masters of the Universe cartoon in the 80s.
Right.
So they've had a long legacy of kind of scoring and producing these iconic children's adventure shows.
Right. The other Batman the Animated Series was a pretty good one too, but that comes from a totally different sort of background than the other cartoons that we're talking about. But yeah, so I mean, we've gone into cartoons off of toys here, but yeah, I'm interested in the next round of the show that we've been talking about, the toys that made us, just to see, because the Transformers thing is those were really, I don't know what came first actually. GoBots technically come before Transformers. I think they may have. I think they may have. We have to maybe look that up, but
we'll look into that while we talk here.
I'll stall while you type. But it was very original set of toys, and those were what caught my imagination the most. To this day, I'm always fascinated by a good Transformers toy. And then when you look them up, it might be tricky because they'll tell you like the cartoons instead of the toy line.
Yeah, that's what I got first.
Yeah,
of course. Let's see here. So we've got the Wikipedia entry loading up. So what we have is that it started as a joint venture between Hasbro of America and Takara of Japan. Takara famous for probably before this, their Star Wars products. They had a wind-up R2-D2 that's one of the more valuable 70s Star Wars collectibles. Transformers was an idea created to rebrand and sell Takara's Diaclone and Microchange line of robot toys.
Oh, wow. Okay.
As a whole new line with new concept behind it, which apparently was also co-developed by Marvel Comics because Hasbro at the time had a partnership with them because of G.I. Joe. So apparently the toys and the cartoon both started in 1984.
Okay, so this is Transformers.
This is still, Transformers.
Okay, so 84.
84 was the big jumping off point.
All right. The GoBots were great, though, because they were like a cheaper alternative. So you could have like the basic Transformers and then kind of fill your collection with GoBots. I actually had some cool Transformers over the years. Again, I never had like a complete set of any given toy. I did have an awesome Optimus Prime. One of the coolest things I had that I don't have anymore was a die-cast Leader 1 from GoBots. Not many people may be familiar with who Leader One is, but he was the leader of the Guardians. He turned into a gray F-14 Tomcat.
They were, initially, were they all diecast or at least part diecast? I remember I had something that was, I think a boat or something from GoBots that was at least partially metal.
Yeah, I don't know if they were all diecast, but I know I had a diecast leader one. That's what I know.
So according to Wikipedia about GoBots, it says that they were introduced by Tonka in 1983, a year before Transformers.
Okay, yeah, so that's...
Oh, no.
I suspected that that may have been the case.
They were shorter-lived.
Right.
But, yeah, I don't think most people would have imagined that the GoBots came first.
They did still produce a cartoon series, too. There was a GoBots cartoon.
Right.
You know what I used to like about GoBots? It used to bother me about Transformers. Although, GoBots suffers from some of the same kind of problems. When a GoBot would transform, its body format was very... You could very easily follow what was happening in the transformation. And the Transformers animated transformations were sometimes all over the place. Like, right. Body parts would just, like, disappear underneath them, and you'd never know where they went. The one thing that the GoBots did suffer from, the same as the Transformers in terms of their animated shows, was that their size changing. Like, one's an F-14 Tomcat, the other one's a motorcycle, but in robot form, they're physical equals.
Right, yeah. I'm always amazed at anybody who tries to draw a picture of a Transformer, let alone draw them multiple times to make them move in an animated form. It must have been just a nightmare. So I can't blame them for taking shortcuts on that.
They were really doing it by hand, too.
My God.
And especially if you look at, like, the quality of the feature-length Transformers animated movie.
Right.
Like, it really holds up. Like, the quality really holds up across the entire, like, hour and a half. It's really impressive what they were able to hand-draw. And to, yeah. Just to maintain the shape's consistency, because every body part has, like, dimension to it and angles and edges, and they maintain it pretty well throughout.
I was never a big Transformers fan, but I can absolutely respect that, you know, absolutely appreciate that.
That Transformers animated movie is one of my favorite movies of all time. Certainly the best Transformers feature-length film ever created.
Yeah, suck it, Michael Bay. just reading up on the GoBots here, it's just interesting to note their relationship to the Transformers. On the surface, it probably was seen as just like the discount competing version of the Transformers. But in reality, as we said, they debuted a year earlier. They were also based on an existing toy line from Japan called Machine Robo. The Japanese versions of the characters were actually human-piloted mecha.
Wow.
In America, they made the decision to make them just sentient robots, like the Transformers.
Right. It's interesting because a lot of times when stuff like that happens, like shows will get like spliced together differently for an American audience.
Right.
Like Robotech is actually two different shows from Japan, and then it gets brought over to America and they splice things together to make one show. Actually, Power Rangers is the same deal. So, exactly. But that didn't seem to be the case with GoBots.
Yeah, I think the cartoon was developed well after the idea of bringing the toy line in from Japan. But oddly enough, Hasbro bought Tonka in 1991. So Hasbro owns both the Transformers and the GoBots. Well, Hasbro owns the character names and the storyline, but they don't own, I guess, the toys themselves. Even from Tonka, were only licensed from Bandai. Huh. In Japan, who is famous, I guess, for making the Power Rangers toys, among other things.
Yep.
So there's still like a weird split ownership of the license. Hasbro decided to make the GoBots part of an alternate universe within the Transformers, I guess.
I would love to see that crossover. I know that's such like an obscure, like niche, nerdy thing that maybe a lot of people wouldn't appreciate, but I would love it so much.
Yeah, it'd be cool. I mean, it seems like they kind of just bought them and swept them under the rug, you know. Kind of similar to what WWE did with WCW.
Right.
They took their biggest competition, bought them, and made them disappear.
Yeah, it's too bad. I mean, the characters weren't always as strong. There was like a good group of basic characters, and it didn't go much deeper than that.
Yeah.
I love some of the names of the GoBots, like Leader One, obviously. But the bad guy was turned into a motorcycle, and his name was Psy-Kill.
Yeah, it was...
His number one henchman was a helicopter... And his name was Kaptor.
It starts to seem like GoBots maybe shared a creative department with Masters of the Universe with some of these character names. They were kind of similar.
it is true, yeah.
The guy and the guy
Manny Faces, for goodness sake.
The guy with the giant metal hand in He-Man was called Fisto.
Well, even Thundercats fell guilty to that. They had a guy, a jackal, and his name was Jackalman.
Right.
They had a monkey, and his name was Monkeyan.
See, the, I think the
They had a mummy, and his name was Mumra. I could go on.
Yeah, yeah. The He-Man formula seemed to be put an O or an or on the end of everything, and the Thundercats formula seemed to be call everybody, you know, creature man. You know, put a man on the end.
Exactly. Although, I mean, Thundercats, again, was pretty... I mean, the good guys were Lion-O, Panthro, Tigra, right, you know.
There you go.
So
they did, Chitara.
Yeah, yeah, Chitara. Jaga, and then if you want to get into the later, they ended up having Lynxo, yep. Who was blind and flew a ship with a braille board. That was great.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm geeking out about Thundercats right now.
Actually, you know what? I didn't even put it together until just now. Jaga's a jaguar, isn't he?
Yes, yes, he is.
Wow, that's embarrassing.
Congratulations, son. This is a big, important moment for you.
You said Jaga. I'm like, well, it doesn't really fit. Oh, wait. Yeah.
It's interesting. It is kind of like it's a connection that you can't not make. Toys and cartoons. I mean, it's obvious why they go together.
Right.
But it's just, yeah, you can't get away from it. When you talk about one, you talk about both. It's just the way it is.
Especially from that era, from the era that we grew up first being exposed to and the era covered on this series, The Toys That Made Us, primarily are all toys that came to prominence in the era when the FCC regulations forbidding... or at least regulating how toys could be advertised and used in media became kind of relaxed. And Masters of the Universe was kind of the first cartoon out of the gate to take advantage of that.
Still had to have their little moral message at the end.
Right. They actually hired a psychologist to help develop those just to make sure that there was some like legitimate educational content. You know, you'll see interviews if you can go on YouTube or if you have any of the DVD sets of these shows with like the writers and people involved in creating the episodes. And a lot of them first of all, a lot of them are very big names in the animation and even comic industry. And some of them are even more branched out and recognized. Like J. Michael Straczynski, who created Babylon 5, was huge. On the writing staff for the Master of the Universe cartoon.
Wow.
Paul Dini, who worked on the Batman the Animated Series, was another staff writer. Yeah, and there's other ones, but those are probably the ones that come to mind as most notable. But yeah, they'll defend and they'll explain, you know, the process that went into creating some of the stories. And obviously these things through the production get watered down and get kind of formatted to be easily put into a 22-minute, you know, children's episode, but
yeah, probably the actual narrative is even shorter when you consider they had to do their little special message. So,
right. But so, I mean, they didn't set out to just, how can I, you know, brainlessly advertise this toy,
mm-hmm.
you right. know?
Well, I don't think any professional writer wants to tell a story. You know what I mean? I mean,
yeah, for sure.
You don't get into that business to be taken advantage of by sort of a corporate system. I mean, it happens to some degree, I think, to anybody who makes it to a certain level. But you figure they still have some sort of artistic validity they want to put forth.
Right. But yeah, so I mean, once Masters of the Universe, or like, as the cartoon is titled, He-Man and the Masters of the Universe, once that came out and kind of like broke the floodgates open, the 80s is probably best remembered as, well, not the decade itself, but that the 80s children's related media is best remembered for just the insane variety of cartoons that were attached to toy lines.
I mean, there's so many that just roll off the tongue. I mean, you know, besides the ones that we've talked about, He-Man, Thundercats, Transformers, G.I. Joe, you've got Silverhawks, you've got Mask. Right. One of my favorites was Centurions, which was an awesome concept and great for toys.
Yeah.
Tons of others.
And even stuff that wasn't even necessarily toy lines, just if it was a presence in pop culture, it got a Saturday morning cartoon at some point. I mean, there was a Pac-Man cartoon.
Yep.
There was a, you know, Q-Bert cartoon, like all kinds of video game
things.
There
was wrestling. I mean, wrestling. You know, All-Star Wrestlers or yep. whatever that was. Rock and Wrestling? Is that what Hulk Hogan's Rock and Wrestling?
Yeah, Hulk Hogan's Rock and Wrestling, I think is what it was.
Yeah, there was another Nintendo one. It was Captain N.
Yep.
And then, you know, like Disney got into, you know, half-hour Saturday morning cartoons.
Yep,
you had you know, Chip and Dale and Tailspin and Darkwing Duck and DuckTales.
Gummy Bears.
Gummy Bears, yep. And even in the early 80s, you know, it kind of starts off with, I don't think they go back to the 70s, the Smurfs. Yeah. Go back to the 70s?
Maybe late 70s. Actually, well,
and Snorkel, the Snorks followed them, you know, it's basically the same thing.
Yeah, the underwater Smurfs. I think the Smurfs from, what are they from, Belgium? I think they existed since the mid-70s over there.
Okay.
I'm just going to look that up real quick.
Sure.
We have...
Oh, Defenders of the Earth. That was another one, by the way. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, Smurfs. Well, actually, Defenders of the Earth took... pulp characters and assemble them into a...
I think at the time it was made, they were all public domain characters.
Right.
So you had Phantom, who's popped up on the podcast before.
Right.
And Mandrake the Magician, Flash Gordon, and I'm forgetting a couple. But yeah, I love that one. That used to pop up like... That would pop up like on weekday mornings before the school bus got home. I remember got to the house. We'd watch that.
It's interesting when certain cartoons end up in obscure time slots in certain markets. Like... Your exposure to them was solely dictated by, I guess, the whims of whatever TV station broadcasts them in your area.
Right. Once they're in syndication, I mean, they're just kind of up for the decision makers of the, you know, local people making those decisions.
Well, yeah, that's what I mean. Like, you could take somebody from Ohio and their Saturday morning memories are totally different from what ours would have been. It's weird.
Right.
Because you had your network cartoons that, like, they had their set lineup, but kind of before and after that, like, the stations could put on whatever the hell they wanted.
Well, you know what's funny, too, is a lot of the cartoons we think of ourselves as having grown up with, were already in syndication by the time we were really watching them.
Right, absolutely.
Because you talk about cartoons that started in 84 or 85, we were 2-3 years old.
Right.
By the time we were old enough to sort of watch them and get it, they were already probably done being produced, like no longer in production and in reruns. Yeah. He-Man and Transformers and Thundercats all fit that mold. The one that hit new as we were watching that made sort of the big waves was the Ninja Turtles cartoon. Right.
Yeah, it's weird what a difference a couple of years makes. He-Man specifically was only produced 2 years, 83 to 85. And then She-Ra took over for it, starting in 85. And but by 87, when the Turtles first debuted, the pilot actually was not just a single episode. From what I remember, it was five episodes. It was like a mini-series, so the beginning... was one giant story.
That's pretty cool, actually.
Yeah. But we were five by then and totally jumping on the bandwagon.
Absolutely. It's interesting. Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, just go back to Smurfs real quick. Shockingly, the actual debut of the Smurfs characters in Belgium was in 1958.
Holy shit. I never would have known that.
Right, me either.
So what I was going to say was, it's interesting about cartoons because you talk about how, like, not G.I. Joe, Masters of the Universe is only really on for 2 years.
Right.
That's really true a lot in cartoons.
Yeah.
And so, but when you're a kid, like 2 years out of the 7 years you've been alive.
Exactly.
Seems like such a big chunk of time. And then even as you get older, you still think of it as this like huge chunk of your existence, of your life, of your experience. But I've seen cartoons come and go since, especially having children who will watch them.
Yeah.
And you think of these cartoons as having like a nothing impact because they're only around for a couple of years. Little do you know that those cartoons are getting into their heads.
For sure.
The same way that these cartoons got into ours. And what I think of as maybe not very significant is super significant to their experience.
Right.
And it's just that it's
their version of it.
Exactly. So it's just interesting to watch them be really into a show like Phineas and Ferb or something.
Right.
It was a really good kids cartoon on Disney Channel. I enjoyed it. It ran for, actually had a pretty good run, maybe 3 or 4 seasons. But it's, you know, it's gone now and I don't think much about it, but they'll still mention it. And it's like, oh yeah, that was like a big deal for you.
Right.
Some of the other ones are legit. Like, you know, SpongeBob is probably the second most successful cartoon of all time. And it doesn't fit the mold of the kind of cartoons we were talking about from our childhood, action cartoons. But, so that's kind of an anomaly, but... A lot of other ones, you see them come and go, and you don't realize. My brother, who's a little bit younger than us, he's really into one called that ran in the 90s called Pirates of Dark Water.
Oh, yeah.
To me, that was like a kind of a cool action cartoon that was on. I didn't really pay much attention. It kind of came and went as I was like in my teenage years. But to him, it like hit the right note at the right time.
Right.
And it was like significant for him. So it's just interesting that you can sort of observe that happening to other people as it happened to you.
It's, you know, that's... it was probably the closest thing to a Thundercats or He-Man type cartoon at that time. It was almost like a decade too late that it came on.
It's true. Because at the time, there were a lot of like Marvel and DC properties being made into cartoons in the 90s. You know, there was a lot. There was an Iron Man. There was like the Action Pack.
Yep.
It was like Iron Man, Hulk. There was a lot of Spider-Man going on. There's a lot of DC. But yeah, that one was pretty unique. And then he got really into anime, which he kind of loses me on anime because I'm not so into that.
Right.
Well, that's certainly something to consider as a topic for a future episode, exploring deeper into different anime films. And I actually have somebody at work that I've been thinking about possibly bringing on as a quote-unquote expert on the topic. So look for that in a future episode, maybe.
Yeah, that was never my... although, you know, there's definitely a crossover. There, you know, some of the studios and some of the styles that created a lot of these cartoons, like Transformers and
Transformers comes to mind.
And Ninja Turtles and even Batman the Animated Series, it's, you think of it as this very specifically styled kind of cartoon film noir where everything looks like it has to fit a very specific plan and in terms of its appearance. If you go back and watch the episodes, the actual action of it is pretty, once you know what to look for, it's pretty clearly done in some Asian country, and it uses very noticeable anime techniques.
Yeah,
so a lot
I
of
think
these...
that's true a lot. And like I said, Transformers especially, because of the whole mech thing. Because
yeah.
Mechas are a big deal over there, and a lot of the faces are drawn in kind of a low-key anime style. Because there's an anime style of face drawing that's very specific. You know, like...
Oh, for sure.
You know, Sparkplug Witwicky doesn't look like anything like a pilot from Robotech.
Right.
But there are still some similarities. And again, especially when you're talking about giant robots, there are. And the same thing for a show like Centurions, which had a lot of technological elements. I mean, basically, that was a show about these guys that wore these suits, and then have these big... sort of mechanical components would attach to their suit, and so they'd become this sort of like walking weapon. Or, well, there was one who was the sky dude, and there was the land guy, and there was the ocean guy, and their names were all very appropriate. As a matter of fact, I'm just going to go through their names right now because it's funny. the sea operations expert was named Max Ray. Ray, get it? Ray.
Oh.
In the ocean, rays. The land guy, the land operations expert was Jake Rockwell. Rocks, get it? Rocks. And the air operations expert was Ace McCloud, which that's...
What's the connection there?
I choose not to explain it, and I'll leave it to your imagination. Pretty great stuff.
To bring it back to the topic that inspired all of this toy talk, the show The Toys That Made Us, Season 2 is... Like I said, it is confirmed. However, there is, unfortunately, no release date set or announced yet.
Well, but, it's pretty long production time for that show. I mean, each episode is like its own full documentary.
Well, I mean, also, I think that a lot of the ones that we were talking about have already been at least started, or some of them are probably completed.
Right.
But I think what they're doing is, in this article that I have here as the source for this news, is speculating that they're just going to take the same approach this year that they did last year and release it around Christmas.
Okay. All right.
Last year it came out on December 22nd. So
I have to say, like, the information that I have is that there's going to be 4 more episodes for this season.
Yeah, it's interesting.
And that whatever you're talking about will come on, will be the new season. I'm doing my own research right now.
I clicked on the newest article to get the most current information, but the way they format it, the way they word it, is kind of confusing.
The thing that I'm looking at is not giving me... Okay, so this says subsequent episodes will feature Lego, Transformers, Hello Kitty, and Star Trek.
Yeah, this article doesn't mention that at all. Okay.
So I think that's going to be the continuation of the first season.
That's cool.
And then season 2 will include some of the things you're talking about.
So I'm going to call out Den of Geek right now for not doing a thorough reporting job.
Now, I am on Wikipedia, which is notoriously not the place to go for accurate research, but this seems reasonable.
Yeah.
Because it says the first season is an 8-episode documentary season, or a series.
Well, that puts my critique of not addressing Transformers earlier to bed, at least. Right. And that's kind of reassuring.
Yeah. And Lego's a big one, too. I love Legos. Well. I will still play with Legos.
Well, if the idea is to talk about and examine the history of toys and popular culture and talk, you know, focus on the big ones, Lego is kind of a no-brainer.
Absolutely.
That's another one that's, God, the evolution of Lego over the years is kind of staggering from what my first introduction to it was and what most of my childhood memories of it are to what it is now. It's just, I mean, it's a universe apart.
Yeah, there's some interesting things with Lego. It's become quite a nerd thing, you know, like everybody wants the biggest Lego set, the new Millennium Falcon and things like that. I don't get the biggest things, and first of all, Legos have become very expensive because everything is licensed properties now.
Right.
It's actually hard to find and buy Legos that are just Legos, not like Harry Potter Legos or Marvel Comics Legos or Star Wars Legos or whatever. So I tend to like just buy small to medium sized sets just so it's financially reasonable. And the other part of it is people build, not just kids but even adults, build these things, and then they just have basically a model of a thing built out of Legos. But to me, that's not in the spirit of Legos.
Right.
And as the Lego movie taught us, Legos are to be played with. So I don't mind, like, my kids, and you know, we'll work on whatever the thing is supposed to be. But eventually that thing comes apart and we build our own stuff.
Yeah, well, that was the appeal. I mean, I guess, you know, before Legos predominantly became kind of like you said, licensed. And also with the licensing comes specific characters and specific patterns that you're supposed to put these things together, like kits designed to become one thing.
Right.
The idea of Legos was basically just like basic building blocks to create whatever the hell you could come up with.
Yeah, absolutely.
And
I will say, sometimes the more complicated sets, as long as you're committed to the idea that eventually you're going to take the stuff apart,
right,
they come with some pretty cool unique parts that can be nicely used for other things.
Right.
Yeah. As a matter of fact, a couple weekends ago, my kids got the Legos out randomly, and they're getting a little older. There's going to come a time soon where they're not playing with toys as much. You know, they're 12 and 10, two daughters.
Yeah, they said that about me once, too.
Well, that's a good point. I am indoctrinating, sorry. I mean, exposing my daughters to all the nerd culture has to offer. But they got out the Legos, and they were building, so I joined them, and I built a badass mech out of all the black and dark gray and light gray pieces that I could find, and it looked really cool. It looked like something right out of MechWarrior, so I was pretty proud of that. But it came together because there was a lot of cool pieces that came off of what used to be Star Wars stuff and what used to be superhero stuff. So I know I had fun. Matter of fact, I kept playing with them long after they stopped.
So how are those stored? Do they just mix them all up and put them in a bin or something? Or?
Well, they have a bin for stuff they want to keep together. So if they build a thing and want to keep the thing for a while, that'll go into the bin that has the stuff that's built together.
Right.
Once something comes apart, it goes into like the all-purpose pile.
Ah, so there is a kind of a hodgepodge collection.
Yes,
where you can pull from.
Yep,
that's pretty cool. That's exactly what I would have done.
Yeah, I think it's a good system. I remember my cousin had some really cool space sets, and I never had the space sets. I always had like the racing sets and the city sets. And he had some really cool like spacey high-tech stuff that I used to love building with his Legos.
Well, that was the coolest. Like, that's almost like the edge of creativity for Legos in terms of, like, you know, these license things didn't exist when we were kids, and it was always like you were taking parts from space or whatever, and like, oh, imagine what it would be like if there was a Star Wars thing, if there was a Lego lightsaber or whatever. You had to kind of like build it yourself.
Yeah
And now it's just like that's all there is, and like, you know? So I don't know, I think there's something to be said for, you know, having to kind of fabricate it on your own out of sheer will.
Yeah, and actually, I mean, there's something sort of, if you want to get serious about it, there's educational aspects to that. You know, it's
definitely,
it's a whole like motor planning / problem solving thing that would be, you know, that's the kind of stuff that in my day job, I'm looking at kids, you know, and their level of development and their small motor and their sort of problem solving techniques and the way that they observe something and move through to the end. And playing with Legos, like, cross, you know, it checks off all those boxes.
Right. I don't know how much I could like trace back of my own development and credit, but I think that it's a significant factor for sure.
Agreed.
Maybe that most people don't think of, But they will now. You better.
Henceforth and forthwith and so on.
So, yeah, season two, Christmas time. If only they would explain when the rest of season one would appear in between. Hopefully you won't have to wait until Christmas for both of them.
It said sometime in 2018. So
oh, God.
It doesn't really narrow it down too very much, but keep checking, I guess.
Sometime between March and December.
Check your local listings.
Your local Netflix listings. yeah, well, I don't know that this episode will run until Christmas, so now seems like as good a spot as any to wrap this up.
Sounds good.
Thanks for playing with us. I've been your friend Claude.
And I'm just Jamie.
And we will see you next time.
Later.
Podcast is a Ghost Factory Internet production brought to you by the WEM.